ear with a small set of foam earphones to listen to demo tapes and rough mixes. Occasionally, he'll hand the device to Mindy, wanting her opinion, and each time, the experience of music pouring directly against her eardrums, hers alone, is a shock that makes her eyes well up. The privacy of it, the way it transforms her surroundings into a golden montage, as if she were looking back on this lark in Africa with Lou from some distant future. Structural incompatibility. A powerful, twice-divorced male will be unable to acknowledge, much less sanction, the ambitions of a much younger female mate. By definition, their relationship will be temporary. Structural desire. The much younger temporary female mate of a powerful male will be inexorably drawn to the single male within range who disdains her mate's power. Albert drives with one elbow out the window. He's been a largely silent presence on this safari, eating quickly in the meal tent, providing terse answers to people's questions. Where do you live?
Mombasa.
How long have you been in Africa?
8 years.
What brought you here?
This and that.
He rarely joins the group around the fire after dinner. On a trip to the outhouse one night, Mindy glimpsed Albert at the other fire near the staff tents, drinking a beer and laughing with the Kikuyu drivers. With the tour group, he rarely smiles. Whenever his eyes happen to graze Mindy's, she senses shame on her behalf. Because of her prettiness, because she sleeps with Lou, because she keeps telling herself this trip constitutes anthropological research into group dynamics and ethnographic enclaves, when really what she's after is luxury, adventure, and a break from her four insomniac roommates. Next to Albert, in the shotgun seat, Kronos is ranting about animals. He's the bassist for the Mad Hatters, one of Lou's bands, and has come on the trip as Lou's guest, along with the Hatters' guitarist and a girlfriend each. These four are locked in a visceral animal sighting competition. Structural fixation, a collective, contextually induced obsession that becomes a temporary locus of greed, competition, and envy. They challenge one another nightly over who saw more and at what range, invoking witnesses from their respective jeeps, and promising definitive proof when they develop their film back home. Behind Albert sits Cora, the travel agent, and beside her, gazing from his window, is Dean, a blonde actor whose genius for stating the obvious, "It's hot," or "The sun is setting," or "There aren't many trees," is a staple source of amusement for Mindy. Dean is starring in a movie whose soundtrack Lou is helping to create. The presumption seems to be that its release will bring Dean immediate and stratospheric fame. In the seat behind him, Rolf and Charlie are showing their Mad magazine to Mildred, one of the birdwatching ladies. She or her companion Fiona can usually be found near Lou, who flirts with them tirelessly and needles them to take him birdwatching. His indulgence of these women in their 70s, strangers to him before this trip, intrigues Mindy. She can find no structural reason for it. In the last row, beside Mindy, Lou thrusts his torso from the open roof and takes pictures, ignoring the rule to stay seated while the jeep is moving. Albert swerves suddenly, and Lou is knocked back into his seat, camera smacking his forehead. He swears at Albert, but the words are lost in the jeep's wobbly jostle through tall grass. They've left the road. Kronos leans out his open window, and Mindy realizes that Albert must be taking this detour for him, giving Kronos a chance to advance against his rivals. Or was the temptation to knock Lou down too sweet to resist? After a minute or two of chaotic driving, the jeep emerges a few feet from a pride of lions. Everyone gawks in startled silence. It's the closest they've been to any animal on this trip. The motor is still running. Albert's hand tentatively on the wheel. But the lions appear so relaxed, so indifferent, that he kills the engine. In the ticking motor silence, they can hear the lions breathe. Two females, one male, three cubs. The cubs and one of the females are gorging on a bloody zebra carcass. The others are dozing.
"They're eating," says Dean.
Kronos' hands shake as he spools film into his camera. "Fuck," he keeps muttering, "fuck." Albert lights a cigarette, forbidden in the brush, and waits, as indifferent to the scene as if he'd paused outside a restroom. "Can we stand?" the children ask. "Is it safe?"
"I'm sure as hell going to," Lou says.
Lou, Charlie, Rolf, Kronos, and Dean all climb on top of their seats and jam their upper halves through the open roof. Mindy is now effectively alone inside the Jeep with Albert, Cora, and Mildred, who peers at the lions through her bird-watching binoculars.
"How did you know?" Mindy asks, after a silence.
Albert swivels around to look at her, down the length of the Jeep. He has unruly hair and a soft brown mustache. There is a suggestion of humor in his face. "Just a guess." "From half a mile away?"
"He probably has a sixth sense," Cora says, "after so many years here."
Albert turns back around and blows smoke through his open window.
"Did you see something?" Mindy persists.
She expects Albert not to turn again, but he does, leaning over the back of his seat, his eyes meeting hers between the children's bare legs. Mindy feels a jolt of attraction, roughly akin to having someone seize her intestines and twist. She understands now that it's mutual. She sees this in Albert's face.
"Broken bushes," he says, resting his eyes on her, "like something got chased. It could have been nothing."
Cora, sensing her exclusion, sighs wearily.
"Can someone come down so I can look too?"
she calls to those above the roof.
"Coming,"
Lou says, but Kronos is faster, ducking back into the front seat and then leaning out his window. Cora rises in her big print skirt. Mindy's face pounds with blood. Her own window, like Albert's, is on the Jeep's left side, facing away from the lions. Mindy watches him wet his fingers and snuff out his cigarette. They sit in silence, hands dangling separately from their windows, a warm breeze stirring the hair on their arms, ignoring the most spectacular animal sighting of the safari.
"You're driving me crazy," Albert says, very softly.
The sound seems to travel out his window and back in through Mindy's, like one of those whispering tubes.
"You must know that."
"I didn't," she murmurs back.
"Well, you are. My hands are tied.
Forever?" She smiles. "Please. An interlude.
Then?
Grad school? Berkeley?" Albert chuckles. Mindy isn't sure what that chuckle means. Is it funny that she's in graduate school, or that Berkeley and Mombasa, where he lives, are irreconcilable locations?
"Kronos, you crazy fuck, get back in here!"
It's Lou's voice from overhead, but Mindy feels sluggish, almost drugged, and reacts only when she hears the change in Albert's voice.
"No," he hisses. "No, back in the Jeep!"
Mindy swivels toward the window on her other side. Kronos is skulking among the lions, holding his camera close to the faces of the sleeping male and female, taking pictures.
"Walk backward," Albert says with hushed urgency. "Backward, Kronos. Gently."
Movement comes from a direction no one is expecting. The female gnawing at the zebra. She vaults at Kronos in an agile, gravity-defying spring that anyone with a house cat would recognize. She lands on his head, flattening him instantly. There are screams,
A gunshot, and those overhead tumble back into their seats so violently that at first Mindy thinks they've been shot. But it's the lioness. Albert has killed her with a rifle he'd secreted somewhere, maybe under his seat. The other lions have run away. All that's left is the zebra carcass and the body of the lioness, Kronos's legs splayed beneath her. Albert, Lou, Dean, and Cora bolt from the jeep. Mindy starts to follow, but Lou pushes her back, and she realizes that he wants her to stay with his children. She leans over the back of their seat and puts an arm around each of them. As they stare through the open windows, a wave of nausea rolls through Mindy. She feels in danger of passing out. Mildred is still in her spot beside the children, and it occurs to Mindy, vaguely, that the elderly bird watcher was inside the jeep the whole time that she and Albert were talking. "Is Kronos dead?" Rolf asks flatly. "I'm sure he's not," Mindy says. "Why isn't he moving?" The lion is on top of him. "See, they're trying to pull her off. He's probably fine under there." "There's blood on the lion's mouth," Charlie says. "That's from the zebra. Remember, she was eating a zebra?" It takes enormous effort to keep her teeth from chattering, but Mindy knows that she must hide her terror from the children. Her belief that whatever turns out to have happened is her fault. They wait in pulsing isolation, surrounded by the hot, blank day. Mildred rests a knobby hand on Mindy's shoulder, and Mindy feels her eyes fill with tears. "He'll be fine," the old woman says gently. "You watch." By the time the group throngs the bar of the Mountain Hotel after dinner, everyone seems to have gained something. Kronos has gained a blistering victory over his bandmate and both girlfriends at the cost of 32 stitches on his left cheek that you could argue are also a gain. He's a rock star, after all. And several huge antibiotic pills administered by an English surgeon with hooded eyes and beery breath, an old friend of Albert's, whom he unearthed in a cinder-block town about an hour away from the lions. Albert has gained the status of a hero, but you wouldn't know it to look at him. He gulps a bourbon and mutters his responses to the giddy queries of the Phoenix faction. No one has yet confronted him on the damning basics. Why were you in the bush? How did you get so close to the lions? Why didn't you stop Kronos from getting out of the jeep? But Albert knows that Ramsay, his boss, will ask these questions, and that they will likely lead to his being fired, the latest in a series of failures brought on by what his mother, back in Minehead, calls his self-destructive tendencies. The members of Ramsay Safari have gained a story they'll tell for the rest of their lives. It will prompt some of them, years from now, to search for each other on Google and Facebook, unable to resist the wish-fulfillment fantasy these portals offer. Whatever happened to... In a few cases, they'll meet again to reminisce and marvel at one another's physical transformations, which will seem to melt away with the minutes. Dean, whose success will elude him until middle age, when he'll land the role of a paunchy, outspoken plumber in a popular sitcom, will meet for an espresso with Louise, now a chubby 12-year-old from the Phoenix faction, who will Google him after her divorce. Post-coffee, they'll repair to a Days Inn off San Vicente for some unexpectedly moving sex, then to Palm Springs for a golf weekend, and finally to the altar, accompanied by Dean's 4 adult children and Louise's 3 teenagers. But this outcome will be the stark exception. Mostly, the reunions will lead to a mutual discovery that having been on a safari 35 years before doesn't qualify as having much in common, and they'll part ways wondering what, exactly, they'd hoped for. The passengers in Albert's jeep have gained the status of witnesses, to be questioned endlessly about what they saw and heard and felt. A gang of children, including Rolf, Charlie, a set of 8-year-old twin boys from Phoenix, and Louise, the chubby 12-year-old, stampede along a slatted path to a blind beside a watering hole, a wooden hut full of long benches with a slot they can peek through, invisible to the animals. It's dark inside. They rush to the slot, but no animals are drinking at the moment.
Did you actually see the lion? Louise asks, with wonder.
Lioness, Rolf says. There were two, plus a lion, and three cubs.
She means the one that got shot, Charlie says, impatient. Obviously we saw it. We were inches away.
Feet, Rolf corrects her.
Feet are made out of inches, Charlie says. We saw everything.
Rolf has already started to hate these conversations, the panting excitement behind them, the way Charlie seems to revel in it. A thought has been troubling him.
I wonder what will happen to the cubs, he says. The lioness who got shot must have been their mom. She was eating with them.
Not necessarily, Charlie says.
But if she was, maybe the dad will take care of them, Charlie says, doubtfully.
The other children are quiet, considering the question.
Lions tend to raise their cubs communally.
A voice comes from the far end of the blind. Mildred and Fiona were already there or have just slipped in. Being old and female, they're easily missed.
The pride will likely take care of them, Fiona says, even if the one killed was their mother.
Which it might not have been, Charlie adds.
Which it might not have been, Mildred agrees.
It doesn't occur to the children to ask Mildred, who was also in the jeep, what she saw.
I'm going back, Rolf tells his sister.
He follows the path back up to the hotel. His father and Mindy are still in the smoky bar. The strange, celebratory feeling unnerves Rolf. His mind bends again and again to the jeep, but his memories are a muddle. The lion is springing, a jerk of impact from the gun. Kronos moaning during the drive to the doctor, blood collecting in an actual puddle under his head on the floor of the jeep, like in a comic book. All of it is suffused with the feel of Mindy holding him from behind, her cheek against his head, her smell. Not bready, like his mom's, but salty, bitter almost. A smell that seems akin to the lions themselves. He stands by his father, who pauses in the middle of an army story he's telling with Ramsay.
You tired, son?
Want me to walk you upstairs? Mindy asks, and Rolf nods. He does want that.
The blue, mosquito-y night pushes in from the hotel windows. Outside the bar, Rolf is suddenly less tired. Mindy collects his key from the front desk, then says, "Let's go out on the porch." They step outside. Dark as it is, the silhouettes of mountains against the sky are even darker. Rolf can dimly hear the voices of the other children down in the blind. He's relieved to have escaped them. He stands with Mindy at the edge of the porch and looks at the mountains. Her salty, tangy smell surrounds him. Rolf senses her waiting for something, and he waits too, his heart stamping. There is a cough farther down the porch. Rolf sees the orange tip of a cigarette move in the dark, and Albert comes toward them with a creak of boots.
Hello there, he says to Rolf.
He doesn't speak to Mindy, and Rolf decides the one hello must be for both of them.
Hello, he greets Albert.
What are you up to? Albert asks. Rolf turns to Mindy.
What are we up to?
Enjoying the night, she says, still facing the mountains, but her voice is tense. We should go up, she tells Rolf, and walks abruptly back inside the hotel. Rolf is troubled by her rudeness.
Are you coming? He asks Albert.
Why not?
The three of them ascend the stairs, sounds of merriment jingling up from the bar. Rolf feels an odd pressure to make conversation.
Is your room up here too? He asks.
Down the hall, Albert says. Number 3. Mindy unlocks the door to Rolf's room and steps inside, leaving Albert in the hall. Rolf is suddenly angry with her.
Want to see my room? He asks Albert. Mine and Charlie's?
Mindy emits a single syllable of laughter, the way his mother laughs when things have annoyed her to a point of absurdity. Albert steps into his room. It's plain, with wood furniture and dusty flowered curtains, but after 10 nights in tents, it feels lavish.
Very nice, Albert says.
With his longish brown hair and mustache, he looks like a real explorer, Rolf thinks. Mindy crosses her arms and stares out the window. There is a feeling in the room that Rolf can't identify. He's angry with Mindy and thinks that Albert must be too. Women are crazy. Mindy's body is slender and elastic. She could slip through a keyhole or under a door. Her thin purple sweater rises and falls quickly as she breathes. Rolf is surprised by how angry he is. Albert taps a cigarette from his pack, but doesn't light it. It is unfiltered tobacco emerging at both ends.
Well, he says, good night to you two.
Rolf had imagined Mindy tucking him into bed, her arm around him again as it was in the Jeep. Now this seems out of the question. He can't change into his pajamas with Mindy there. He doesn't even want her to see his pajamas, which have small blue elves all over them.
I'm fine, he tells her, hearing the coldness in his voice. You can go back.
Okay, she says. She turns down his bed, plumps the pillow, adjusts the open window. Rolf senses her finding reasons not to leave the room.
Your dad and I will be just next door, Mindy says. You know that, right?
Duh,
he mutters. Then chastened, he says, I know. 3. Sand. 5 days later, they take a long, very old train overnight to Mombasa. Every few minutes, it slows down just enough for people to leap from the doors, bundles clutched to their chests, and for others to scramble on. Lou's group and the Phoenix faction install themselves in the cramped bar car, which they share with African men in suits and bowler hats. Charlie is allowed to drink one beer, but she sneaks 2 more with the help of handsome Dean, who stands beside her narrow bar stool.
You're sunburned, he says, pressing a finger to Charlie's cheek. The African sun is strong.
True, Charlie says, grinning as she swigs her beer.
Now that Mindy has pointed out Dean's platitudes, Charlie finds him hilarious.
You have to wear sunscreen, he says.
I know. I did.
Once isn't enough. You have to reapply.
Charlie catches Mindy's eye and succumbs to giggles. Her father moves close.
What's so funny?
Life, Charlie says, leaning against him.
Life? Lou snorts. How old are you?
He hugs her to him. When Charlie was little, he did this all the time, but as she grows older, it happens less. Her father is warm, almost hot, his heartbeat like someone banging on a heavy door.
Ow, Lou says. Your quill is stabbing me.
It's a black and white porcupine quill. She found it in the hills and uses it to pin up her long hair. Her father slides it out, and the golden, tangled mass of Charlie's hair collapses onto her shoulders like a shattered window. She's aware of Dean watching.
I like this, Lou says, squinting at the quill's translucent point. It's a dangerous weapon.
Weapons are necessary, Dean says.
By the next afternoon, the safari goers have settled into a hotel a half hour up the coast from Mombasa. On a white beach, traversed by knobby-chested men selling beads and gourds, Mildred and Fiona
gamely appear in floral print swimsuits, binoculars still at their necks. The livid Medusa tattoo on Kronos's chest is less startling than his small pot belly, a disillusioning trait he shares with a number of the men, the fathers especially. Not Lou. He's lean, a little ropey, tanned from occasional surfing. He walks toward the cream-colored sea with his arm around Mindy, who looks even better than expected, and expectations were high, in her sparkling blue bikini. Charlie and Rolf lie together under a palm tree. Charlie disdains the red Danskin one-piece she chose with her mother for this trip, and decides she will borrow a pair of sharp scissors from the front desk and cut it into a bikini.
I never want to go home, she says sleepily. I miss Mom, Rolf says.
His father and Mindy are swimming. He can see the glitter of her swimsuit through the pale water.
But if Mom could come.
Dad doesn't love her anymore, Rolf says. She's not crazy enough.
What's that supposed to mean?
Rolf shrugs.
You think he loves Mindy?
No way. He's tired of Mindy.
What if Mindy loves him?
Who cares? Charlie says. They all love him.
After his swim, Lou goes in search of spears and snorkeling gear, resisting the temptation to follow Mindy back to their room, though clearly she'd like him to. She's gone bananas in a sack since they left the tents. Women can be funny about tents. Hungry for it now, pawing off Lou's clothes at odd moments, ready to start again when he's barely finished. He feels tenderly toward Mindy, now that the trip is winding down. She's studying something at Berkeley, and Lou has never traveled for a woman. It's doubtful that he'll lay eyes on her again. Rolf is reading in the sand when Lou arrives with the snorkeling equipment, but he puts aside the Hobbit without protest and stands. Charlie ignores them, and Lou wonders momentarily if he should have included her. He and Rolf walk to the edge of the sea and pull on their masks and flippers, hanging their spears from belts at their sides. Rolf looks thin. He needs more exercise. He's timid in the water. His mother is a reader and a gardener, and Lou is constantly having to fight her influence. He wishes that Rolf could live with him, but the lawyers just shake their heads whenever he mentions it. The fish are gaudy, easy targets, nibbling at coral. Lou has speared 7 by the time he realizes Rolf hasn't killed a single one.
What's the problem, son?
He asks when they surface.
I just like watching them, Rolf says.
They've drifted toward a spit of rocks extending into the sea. Carefully, they climb from the water. Tide pools throng with starfish and urchins and sea cucumbers. Rolf crouches, poring over them. Lou's fish hang from a netted bag at his waist. From the beach, Mindy is watching them through Fiona's binoculars. She waves, and Lou and Rolf wave back.
Dad?
Rolf asks, lifting a tiny green crab from a tide pool.
What do you think about Mindy?
Mindy's great. Why?
The crab splays its little claws. Lou notes with approval that his son knows how to hold it safely. Rolf squints up at him.
You know, is she the right amount of crazy?
Lou gives a hoot of laughter. He'd forgotten the earlier conversation, but Rolf forgets nothing, a quality that delights his father.
She's crazy enough, but crazy isn't everything.
I think she's rude, Rolf says.
Rude to you?
No, to Albert.
Lou turns to his son, cocking his head.
Albert?
Rolf releases the crab and begins to tell the story. He remembers each thing, the porch, the stairs, number 3, realizing as he speaks how much he's wanted to tell his father this, as punishment to Mindy. His father listens keenly, without interrupting. But as Rolf goes on, he senses the story landing heavily, in a way he doesn't understand. When he finishes talking, his father takes a long breath and lets it out. He looks back at the beach. It's nearly sunset, and people are shaking fine white sand from their towels and packing up for the day. The hotel has a disco, and the group plans to go dancing there after dinner.
When exactly did this happen? Lou asks.
The same day as the lions, that night.
Rolf waits a moment, then asks,
Why do you think she was rude like that?
Women are cunts, his father says. That's why.
Rolf gapes at him. His father is angry, a muscle jumping in his jaw, and without warning, Rolf is angry too, assailed by a deep, sickening rage that stirs in him very occasionally when he and Charlie come back from a riotous weekend around their father's pool, rock stars jamming on the roof, guacamole and big pots of chili, to find their mother alone in her bungalow, drinking peppermint tea. Rage at this man who casts everyone aside.
They are not, he can't make himself repeat the word.
They are,
Lou says tightly.
Pretty soon you'll know it for sure.
Rolf turns away from his father. There is nowhere to go, so he jumps into the sea and begins slowly paddling back toward shore. The sun is low, the water choppy and full of shadows. Rolf imagines sharks just under his feet, but he doesn't turn or look back. He keeps swimming toward that white sand, knowing instinctively that his struggle to stay afloat is the most exquisite torture he can concoct for his father. Also that, if he sinks, Lou will jump in instantly and save him. That night, Rolf and Charlie are allowed to have wine at dinner. Rolf dislikes the sour taste, but enjoys the swimmy blur it makes of his surroundings, the giant beak-like flowers all over the dining room, his father's speared fish cooked by the chef with olives and tomatoes, Mindy in a shimmery green dress. His father's arm is around her. He isn't angry anymore, so neither is Rolf. Lou has spent the past hour in bed, fucking Mindy senseless. Now he keeps one hand on her slim thigh, reaching under her hem, waiting for that cloudy look she gets. Lou is a man who cannot tolerate defeat, can't perceive it as anything but a spur to his own inevitable victory. He has to win. He doesn't give a shit about Albert. Albert is invisible. Albert is nothing. In fact, Albert has left the group and returned to his Mombasa apartment. What matters now is that Mindy understand this. He refills Mildred's and Fiona's wine glasses until their cheeks are patchy and flushed.
You still haven't taken me birdwatching, he chides them. I keep asking, but it never happens.
We could go tomorrow, Mildred says. There are some coastal birds we're hoping to see.
Is that a promise?
A solemn promise.
Come on, Charlie whispers to Rolf. Let's go outside.
They slip from the crowded dining room and skitter onto the silvery beach. The palm trees make a slapping, rainy sound, but the air is dry.
It's like Hawaii, Rolf says, wanting it to be true.
The ingredients are there. The dark, the beach, his sister. But it doesn't feel the same.
Without the rain, Charlie says. Without Mom, Rolf says. I think he's gonna marry Mindy, Charlie says. No way. You said he didn't love her. So? He can still marry her.
They sink onto the sand, still faintly warm, radiating a lunar glow. The ghost sea tumbles against it.
She's not so bad, Charlie says.
I don't like her.
And why are you the world's expert?
Charlie shrugs.
I know Dad.
Charlie doesn't know herself. 4 years from now, at 18, she'll join a cult across the Mexican border whose charismatic leader promotes a diet of raw eggs. She'll nearly die from salmonella poisoning before Lou rescues her. A cocaine habit will require partial reconstruction of her nose, changing her appearance, and a series of feckless, domineering men will leave her solitary in her late 20s, trying to broker peace between Rolf and Lou, who will have stopped speaking. But Charlie does know her father. He'll marry Mindy because that's what winning means, and because Mindy's eagerness to conclude this odd episode and return to her studies will last until precisely the moment she opens the door to her Berkeley apartment and walks into the smell of simmering lentils, one of the cheap stews she and her roommates survive on. She'll collapse on a sway-backed couch they found on the sidewalk and unpack her many books, realizing that in weeks of lugging them through Africa, she's read virtually nothing. And when the phone rings, her heart will flip. Structural dissatisfaction. Returning to circumstances that once pleased you, having experienced a more thrilling or opulent way of life, and finding that you can no longer tolerate them. But we're getting off the subject. Rolf and Charlie are galloping up the beach, drawn by the pulse of light and music from the open-air disco. They run barefoot into the crowd, trailing powdery sand onto a translucent dance floor overlaid on lozenges of flashing color. The shuddering bass line seems to interfere with Rolf's heartbeat. "Come on," Charlie says, "let's dance." She begins to undulate in front of him, the way the new Charlie is planning to dance when she gets home. But Rolf is embarrassed. He can't dance that way. The rest of the group surrounds them. Chubby Louise, 1 year older than he, is dancing with Dean, the actor. Ramsey flings his arms around one of the Phoenix faction moms. Lou and Mindy dance close together, their whole bodies touching. But Mindy is thinking of Albert, as she will periodically after marrying Lou and having two daughters, his fifth and sixth children, in quick succession, as if sprinting against the inevitable drift of his attention. On paper, he'll be penniless, and Mindy will end up working as a travel agent to support her little girls. For a time, her life will be joyless. The girls will seem to cry too much, and she'll think longingly of this trip to Africa as the last happy moment of her life, when she still had a choice, when she was free and unencumbered. She'll dream senselessly, futilely, of Albert, wondering what he might be doing at particular times, how her life would have turned out if she'd run away with him as he'd suggested, half-joking, when she visited him in room number 3. Later, of course, she'll recognize Albert as nothing more than a focus of regret for her own immaturity and disastrous choices. When both her children are in high school, she'll finally resume her studies, complete her PhD at UCLA, and begin an academic career at 45, spending long periods of the next 30 years doing social structures fieldwork in the Brazilian rainforest. Her youngest daughter will go to work for Lou, become his protege, and inherit his business. "Look," Charlie tells Rolf over the music, "the bird watchers are watching us." Mildred and Fiona are sitting on chairs beside the dance floor, waving at Rolf and Charlie in their long print dresses. It's the first time the children have seen them without binoculars. "I guess they're too old to dance," Rolf says. "Or maybe we remind them of birds," Charlie says. "Or maybe, when there are no birds, they watch people," Rolf says. "Come on, Rolfus," Charlie says. "Dance with me." She takes hold of his hands. As they move together, Rolf feels his self-consciousness miraculously fade, as if he were growing up right there on the dance floor, becoming a boy who dances with girls like his sister. Charlie feels it too. In fact, this particular memory is one she'll return to again and again for the rest of her life, long after Rolf has shot himself in the head in their father's house at 28. Her brother, as a boy, hair slicked flat, eyes sparkling, shyly learning to dance. But the woman who remembers won't be Charlie. After Rolf dies, she'll revert to her real name, Charlene, unlatching herself forever from the girl who danced with her brother in Africa.
Charlene will cut her hair short and go to law school. When she gives birth to a son, she'll want to name him Rolf, but her parents will still be too shattered. So she'll call him that privately, just in her mind. And years later, she'll stand with her mother among a crowd of cheering parents beside a field, watching him play, a dreamy look on his face as he glances at the sky.
Charlie, Rolf says, guess what I just figured out?
Charlie leans toward her brother, who is grinning with his news.
He cups both hands into her hair to be heard above the thudding beat. His warm, sweet breath fills her ear.
I don't think those ladies were ever watching birds, Rolf says.
Chapter 5. You, plural. It's all still there. The pool with its blue and yellow tiles from Portugal, water laughing softly down a black stone wall. The house is the same, except quiet. The quiet makes no sense. Nerve gas? Overdoses? Mass arrests? I wonder, as we follow a maid through a curve of carpeted rooms, the pool blinking at us past every window. What else could have stopped the unstoppable parties? But it's nothing like that. 20 years have passed. He's in the bedroom, in a hospital bed, tubes up his nose. The second stroke really knocked him out. The first one wasn't so bad, just one of his legs was a little shaky. That's what Benny told me on the phone. Benny from high school, our old friend, Lou's protege. He tracked me down at my mother's, even though she left San Francisco years ago, and followed me to L.A. Benny the organizer, rounding up people from the old days to say goodbye to Lou. It seems you can find almost anyone on a computer. He found Rhea all the way in Seattle, with a different last name. Of our old gang, only Scotty has disappeared. No computer can find him. Rhea and I stand by Lou's bed, unsure what to do. We know him from a time when there was no such thing as normal people dying. There were clues, hints about some bad alternative to being alive. We remembered them together over coffee, Rhea and I, before coming to see him, staring at each other's new faces across the plastic table, our familiar features rinsed in weird adulthood. There was Scotty's mom, of course, who died from pills when we were still in high school, but she wasn't normal. My father, from AIDS, but I hardly saw him by then. Anyway, those were catastrophes. Not like this. Prescriptions by the bed, a leaden smell of medicine, and vacuumed carpet. It reminds me of being in the hospital. Not the smell, exactly. The hospital doesn't have carpets. But the dead air, the feeling of being far away from everything. We stand there, quiet. My questions all seem wrong. How did you get so old? Was it all at once in a day, or did you peter out bit by bit? When did you stop having parties? Did everyone else get old too, or was it just you? Are other people still here, hiding in the palm trees or holding their breath underwater? When did you last swim your laps? Do your bones hurt? Did you know this was coming and hide that you knew? Or did it ambush you from behind? Instead I say, hi, Lou. And at the very same time, Rhea says, wow, everything is just the same. And we both laugh. Lou smiles, and the shape of that smile, even with the yellow shocked teeth inside it, is familiar, a warm finger poking at my gut. His smile, coming open in this strange place. You girls still look gorgeous, he gasps. He's lying. I'm 43 and so is Rhea, married with 3 children in Seattle. I can't get over that. 3. I'm back at my mother's again, trying to finish my BA at UCLA Extension after some long, confusing detours. Your desultory 20s, my mother calls my lost time, trying to make it sound reasonable and fun.
but it started before I was 20 and lasted much longer. I'm praying it's over. Some mornings, the sun looks wrong outside my window. I sit at the kitchen table, shaking salt into the hairs on my arm, and a feeling shoves up in me. It's finished. Everything went past, without me. Those days I know not to close my eyes for too long, or the fun will really start.
Oh, Lou, we're two old bags, admit it,
Rhea says, swatting at his frail shoulder. She shows him the pictures of her kids, holding them close to his face. She's cute, he says about the oldest, Nadine, who is 16. I think he winks, or maybe it's his eye twitching.
Cut it out, you,
Rhea says. I don't say anything. I feel it, the finger, again, in my stomach.
What about your kids?
Rhea asks Lou.
You see them much?
Some, he says, in his strangled new voice. He had six. From three marriages, he bored through and then kicked away. Rolf, the second oldest, was his favorite. Rolf lived here, in this house, a gentle boy with blue eyes that broke a little whenever he stared down his father. Rolf and I were the same age, exactly. Same birthday, same year. I used to imagine us, tiny babies in different hospitals, crying at the same time. We stood naked once, side by side in a full-length mirror, trying to see if being born the same day had left a clue on us, some mark we could find. By the end, Rolf wouldn't speak to me, would walk out of a room when I came in it. Lou's big bed with the crushed purple spread is gone, thank God. The TV is new, flat and long, and its basketball game has a nervous sharpness that makes the room and even us look smudged. A guy comes in dressed in black, a diamond in his ear, and he fiddles with Lou's tubes and takes his blood pressure. From under the covers, tubes twirl from other parts of Lou into clear plastic bags I try not to look at. A dog barks. Lou's eyes are shut, and he snores. The stylish nurse butler checks his wristwatch and leaves. So this is it, what cost me all that time. A man who turned out to be old. A house that turned out to be empty. I can't help it. I start to cry. Rhea puts her arms around me. Even after all the years, she doesn't hesitate. Her skin hangs loose. Freckled skin ages prematurely, Lou told me once. And Rhea is all freckles.
Our friend Rhea,
he said.
She's doomed. You have three children.
I sob into her hair.
Shh. What do I have?
Kids I remember from high school are making movies, making computers, making movies on computers. A revolution, I keep hearing people say. I'm trying to learn Spanish. At night, my mother tests me with flashcards. Three children. The oldest, Nadine, is almost my age when I met Lou. 17. Hitchhiking. He was driving a red Mercedes. In 1979, that could be the beginning of an exciting story, a story where anything might happen. Now it's a punchline.
It was all for no reason, I say.
That's never true, Rhea says. You just haven't found the reason yet.
The whole time, Rhea knew what she was doing. Even dancing, even sobbing. Even with a needle in her vein, she was half pretending. Not me.
I got lost, I say.
It's turning out to be a bad day. A day when the sun feels like teeth. Tonight, when my mother comes home from work and sees me, she'll say,
"Forget the Spanish,"
and fix us Virgin Marys with little umbrellas. With Dave Brubeck on the stereo, we'll play dominoes or gin rummy. When I look at my mother, she gives me a smile. Each time, but exhaustion has carved up her face. The silence takes on a kind of intelligence, and we see Lou watching us. His eyes are so vacant, I think he might be dead.
Haven't been outside in weeks, he says, coughing a little. haven't wanted to. Rhea pushes the bed. I come a step behind, pulling the IV drip on its wheels. As we move him through the house, I feel dread, as if the combination of sunlight and hospital beds could cause an explosion. I'm afraid the real Lou will be outside by the pool, where he lived with a red phone on a long cord and a bowl of green apples, and the real Lou and this old Lou will have a fight. How dare you? I've never had an old person in my house and I'm not going to start now. Age, ugliness, they had no place. They would never get in from outside. There, he says, meaning by the pool, like always. There's still a phone, a black remote on a small glass table, a fruit shake next to it. The nurse butler or some other employee, spreading his wings on the empty grounds. Or Rolf? Could Rolf still be here, taking care of his dad? Rolf in the house? And I feel him, then, exactly like before, when I could tell if he'd walked in a room without having to look. Just by how the air moved. Once, we hid behind the pool house after a concert. Lou yelling for me, Jocelyn! Jocelyn! Rolf and I giggling while the generator droned in our chests. Later, I thought, my first kiss. Which was crazy. Everything I would ever do, I'd done by then. In the mirror, Rolf's chest was smooth. There was no mark. The mark was everywhere. The mark was youth. And when it happened, in Rolf's tiny bedroom, sun sneaking through the shades and stripes, I pretended it was new. He looked inside my eyes, and I felt how normal I could still be. We were smooth, both of us. Where's that thing? Lou asks, meaning the button pad to tilt the bed. He wants to sit up and look out like he used to, in his red bathing suit, tanned legs smelling of chlorine. The phone in his hand and me between his legs, his palm on my head. The birds must have chirped then, too, but we didn't hear them over the music. Or are there more birds now? The bed whines as it hoists him up. He looks out, eyes reaching. I got old, he says. The dog is barking again. The water sways in the pool as if someone has just gotten in or out. What about Rolf? I ask, my first words since hi. Rolf, Lou says, and blinks. Your son? Rolf? Rhea shakes her head at me. My voice is too loud. I feel a kind of anger that fills up my head sometimes and rubs out my thoughts like chalk. Who is this old man dying in front of me? I want the other one, the selfish, devouring man, the one who turned me around between his legs out here in the wide open, pushing the back of my head with his free hand while he laughed into the phone, not caring that every room in the house faced this pool, his son's, for example. I have a thing or two to say to that one. Lou is trying to speak. We lean close, listening. Habit, I guess. Rolf didn't make it. He says, what are you talking about? I say. Now the old man is crying. Tears leak down his face.
What's the point, Jocelyn?
Rhea asks me, and in that second, different parts of my brain find each other, and I realize that I already knew about Rolf. And Rhea knew. Everyone knew. An old tragedy. He was 28, Lou says. I shut my eyes. Long time ago, he says, the words splitting in his wheezy chest. But, yes it was. 28 was a long time ago. The sun hurts my eyes, so I keep them shut.
Losing a child,
Rhea murmurs.
I can't imagine it.
The anger squeezes. It mashes me from inside. My arms ache. I reach underneath Lou's hospital bed. I heave it up and over so he slides into the turquoise pool and the IV needle tears out of his arm, blood spinning after it, feathering in the water and turning a kind of yellow. I'm that strong, even after so much. I jump in after him, Rhea shrieking now. I jump in and I hold him down,
lock his head between my kneecaps and hold him there until everything goes soft and we're just waiting. Lou and I are waiting. And then he shakes, flailing between my legs, jerking as the life goes out of him. When he's absolutely still, I let him float to the top. I open my eyes. No one has moved. Lou is still crying, searching the pool with his blank eyes. Through the sheet, Rhea is touching his chest. It's a bad day. The sun hurts my head. I should kill you, I say, looking at him straight. You deserve to die.
Enough,
Rhea says, with her sharp mother's voice. Suddenly, Lou looks in my eyes. It feels like the first time all day. Finally, I can see him. That man who said, "You're the best thing that ever happened to me," and "We'll see the whole goddamn world," and "How come I need you so much?" And "Looking for a ride, kiddo?" Grinning in the hard sun, puddles of it on his bright red car. "Just tell me where." He looks scared, but he smiles. The old smile back again. "Too late," he says. "Too late." I tilt my head at the roof. Rolf and I sat up there a whole night once, spying down on a party Lou was having for one of his bands. Even after the noise stopped, we stayed, our backs on the cool tiles. We were waiting for the sun. It came up fast, small and bright and round. "Like a baby," Rolf said, when I started to cry. This fragile new sun in our arms. Every night, my mother ticks off another day I've been clean. It's more than a year, my longest yet.
"Jocelyn, you've got so much life in front of you," she says.
And when I believe her, for a minute, there's a lifting over my eyes, like walking out of a dark room. Lou is speaking again, trying to speak.
"Stand on each side of me, would you girls?"
Rhea holds his hand, and I take the other one. It's not the same hand as before. It is bulbous and dry and heavy. Rhea and I look at each other across him. We're there, the three of us, like before. We're back to the beginning. He stopped crying. He's looking at his world. The pool, the tiles. We never did get to Africa, or anywhere. We barely left this house.
"Nice to be with you girls,"
he says, fighting to breathe. Clutching our hands as if we might flee, but we don't. We look at the pool, and we listen to the birds.
"Another minute," he says. "Thank you, girls. One more. Like this."
Chapter 6 X's and O's. Here's how it started. I was sitting on a bench in Tompkins Square Park, reading a copy of Spin I'd swiped from Hudson News, observing East Village females crossing the park on their way home from work, and wondering, as I often did, how my ex-wife had managed to populate New York with thousands of women who looked nothing like her but still brought her to mind, when I made a discovery. My old friend, Benny Salazar, was a record producer. It was right in Spin magazine, a whole article about Benny and how he'd made his name on a group called The Conduits that went multi-platinum 3 or 4 years ago. There was a picture of Benny receiving some kind of award, looking out of breath and a little cross-eyed, one of those frozen, hectic instants you just know has a whole happy life attached. I looked at the picture for less than a second, then I closed the magazine. I decided not to think about Benny. There's a fine line between thinking about somebody and thinking about not thinking about somebody, but I have the patience and the self-control to walk that line for hours, days if I have to. After 1 week of not thinking about Benny, thinking so much about not thinking about Benny that there was barely room left in my brain for thoughts of any other kind, I decided to write him a letter. I addressed it to his record label, which turned out to be inside a green glass building on Park Avenue and 52nd Street. I took the subway up there and stood outside the building with my head back, looking up, up, wondering how high Benny's office might possibly be.
I kept my eyes on the building as I dropped the letter into the mailbox directly in front of it. "Hey, Benjo," I'd written. That was what I used to call him. "Long time no see. I hear you're the man now. Congrats. Couldn't have happened to a luckier guy. Best wishes, Scotty Houseman." He wrote back. His letter arrived in my dented East 6th Street mailbox about 5 days later, typed, which I guess meant a secretary had done it, but I could tell it was Benny all right.
"Scotty, baby, hey, thanks for the note. Where have you been hiding yourself? I still think of the dildo days sometimes. Hope you're playing that slide guitar. Yours, Benny."
With his little wiggly signature above the typed name. Benny's letter had quite an effect on me. Things had gotten, what's the word? Dry. Things had gotten sort of dry for me. I was working for the city as a janitor in a neighborhood elementary school, and in summers, collecting litter in the park alongside the East River near the Williamsburg Bridge. I felt no shame whatsoever in these activities, because I understood what almost no one else seemed to grasp, that there was only an infinitesimal difference, a difference so small that it barely existed except as a figment of the human imagination, between working in a tall green glass building on Park Avenue and collecting litter in a park. In fact, there may have been no difference at all. I happened to have the next day off, the day after Benny's letter came, so I went to the East River early that morning and fished. I did this all the time, and I ate the fish, too. Pollution was present, yes, but the beauty of it was that you knew all about that pollution, unlike the many poisons you consumed each day in ignorance. I fished, and God must have been on my side, or maybe it was Benny's good luck rubbing off on me, because I pulled from the river my best catch of all time. An enormous striped bass. My fishing pals, Sammy and Dave, were shocked to see me catch this superb fish. I stunned it, wrapped it in newspaper, bagged it, and carried it home under my arm. I put on the closest thing I had to a suit, khaki pants and a jacket that I dry-cleaned a lot. The week before, I'd taken it to the cleaners, still in its dry-cleaning bag, which caused a breakdown in the gal behind the counter. "Why you clean? You already clean, bag not open, you waste your money." I know I'm getting off the subject here, but let me just say that I whipped my jacket out of its plastic bag with such force that she went quiet, and I laid it carefully on the dry cleaning counter. "Merci pour vous considération, madame," I said, and she accepted the garment without another word. Suffice it to say that the jacket I put on that morning to visit Benny Salazar was one clean jacket. Benny's building looked like a place where they could implement tough security checks if they needed to, but that day, I guess they didn't need to. More of Benny's good luck flowing down on me like honey. Not that my luck was generally so bad. I would have called it neutral, occasionally edging toward bad. For example, I caught fewer fish than Sammy, though I fished more often and had the better rod. But if it was Benny's good luck I was getting that day, did that mean my good luck was also his good luck? That my visiting him unexpectedly was good luck for him? Or had I somehow managed to divert his luck and siphon it away for a time, leaving him without any luck that day? And if I had managed to do the latter, how had I done it? And most important, how could I do it forever? I checked the directory, saw that Sauzier Records was on 45, took the elevator up there, and breezed through a pair of beige glass doors into a waiting room, which was very swank. The decor reminded me of a 70s bachelor pad. Black leather couches, thick shag rug, heavy glass and chrome tables covered with vibe and rolling stone and the like. Carefully dim lighting. This last was a must, I knew, so musicians could wait there without putting their bloodshot eyes and track marks on display. I slapped my fish on the marble reception desk. It made a good, hard, wet thwack, I swear to God. It sounded like nothing so much as a fish. She, reddish hair, green eyes, flower petal mouth, the sort of chick who makes you want to lean over and say to her oh so sweetly, "You must be really intelligent. How else would you have gotten this job?" looked up and said, "Hi there. I'm here to see Benny," I said. "Benny Salazar. Is he expecting you?" "Not at this moment. Your name? Scotty." She wore a headset that I realized when she spoke into a tiny extension over her mouth was actually a telephone. After she said my name, I caught a curl to her lips, like she was hiding a smile.
He's in a meeting, she told me. But I can take a
I'll wait. I deposited my fish on the glass coffee table next to the magazines and settled into a black leather couch. Its cushions sighed out the most delicious smell of leather. A deep comfort seeped through me. I began to feel sleepy. I wanted to stay there forever, abandon my East 6th Street apartment and live out the remainder of my life in Benny's waiting room. True, it had been a while since I'd spent much time in public. But was such a fact even relevant in our information age, when you could scour planet Earth and the universe without ever leaving the green velvet couch you'd pulled from a garbage dump and made the focal point of your East 6th Street apartment? I began each night by ordering Hunan string beans and washing them down with Jägermeister. It was amazing how many string beans I could eat. 4 orders, 5 orders, more sometimes. I could tell by the number of plastic packets of soy sauce and chopsticks included with my delivery that Fong Yu believed I was serving string beans to a party of 8 or 9 vegetarians. Does the chemical composition of Jägermeister cause a craving for string beans? Is there some property of string beans that becomes addictive on those rare occasions when they're consumed with Jägermeister? I asked myself these questions as I shoveled string beans into my mouth, huge, crunchy forkfuls, and watched TV, weird cable shows, most of which I couldn't identify and didn't watch much of. You might say I created my own show out of all those other shows, which I suspected was actually better than the shows themselves. In fact, I was sure of it. Here was the bottom line. If we human beings are information processing machines, reading X's and O's and translating that information into what people oh so breathlessly call experience, and if I had access to all that same information via cable TV and any number of magazines that I browse through at Hudson News for 4 and 5 hour stretches on my free days, my record was 8 hours, including the half hour I spent manning the register during the lunch break of one of the younger employees who thought I worked there. If I had not only the information, but the artistry to shape that information using the computer inside my brain, real computers scared me. If you can find them, then they can find you, and I didn't want to be